Here's Damien Carrick now with the Law Report.
Thanks, Peter. Having children, growing old and saving money, three good things. But when they mix, they can sometimes form a volatile and destructive legal cocktail. Today we look at the perils of powers of attorney and the fallout that can sometimes arise from family agreements.
Gone are the days, Damien, when we retired at 65 and then dropped dead at 66, still clutching the gold watch. The reality is, we tend now to live much longer past that retirement age, and that creates all sorts of legal and family conundrums.
Carers have given up their own incomes to care for someone. The spiral is down into poverty unless there's some money in the family.
What we're talking about here is paying compensation in exchange for care. And for many Australians, that's a cultural no-no, that children should be expected to provide care for their parents for nothing.
One of the big problems with care agreements is that they do tend to be very general and vague. It's usually nothing more than a promise either made orally or written down to take care of the other person for the rest of their life.
As we grow old and frail, we all want to be cared for by loved ones. But as in all human relationships, economics play a part. If you want care, you have to contribute to the household. For older people, that can sometimes mean transferring assets to their children in return for the promise that they'll be cared for. This arrangement is known as a family agreement. Brian Hurd is a partner with Cain and Hurd Solicitors in Brisbane.
I often see the results of these sorts of arrangements breaking down, where, for example, daughter comes to mum one day and says, "Mum, why don't you move in tomorrow?" And they don't think or address the contingencies of that sort of proposal. I had a recent case, for example, where my client, the mother, who was quite elderly and sick, the daughter offered for mum to sell her unit and move in with her over a cup of tea one Saturday morning. Not only that, she said to mum, "When you get the proceeds from the sale of your unit, put them into my bank account." And I think obviously this was some attempt to avoid the strictures of the Social Security Act. In any event, mum sold her unit, gave the $80,000 to her daughter, promptly moved in with her daughter, and 2 months later was evicted because they simply couldn't get on. And then mum turned around to the daughter and said, "Daughter, please repay me the $80,000 I've given you." And the daughter then promptly refused, saying, of course, the $80,000 was a gift. Now, that's when mum came to see me, when it was all over, when it was all too late, and the whole family arrangement had imploded.
What were you able to do for this woman?
We had to institute legal proceedings. And as a result of those legal proceedings, the matter didn't settle. It went to a trial. And eventually the court decided that the $80,000 was not a gift, that the daughter held it on trust for the mother, and it was to be repaid. Unfortunately, the mother died, in fact, before the $80,000 was to be repaid, but it was ultimately repaid to the estate. And the irony of that was, in order to repay the $80,000, the daughter was forced to sell her home in order to meet that debt ordered by the court. So you can see the sort of calamitous consequences that can occur not just for mum in that situation, but also for the daughter, because they simply didn't get together and discuss the implications of that arrangement.
And you're saying that a good deal of everybody's assets were swallowed in legal costs, and that daughter and the other children and the mother were all substantially financially disadvantaged by this spat.
That's right, because the legal costs amounted to approximately $50,000 in relation to an $80,000 claim. Now, that's ridiculous when legal costs get to that extent in relation to a claim of that size. But the reality was the daughter had no capacity to pay, so we had to get a judgment in order to force the sale of the home.
Brian Hurd, partner with Cain and Hurd Solicitors in Brisbane. Of course, things don't always go awry. Thousands of Australian families take care of their elderly relatives. The relationships are loving and don't give rise to legal complications. If families are considering transferring assets in return for care, one way to help ensure a happy outcome is by sitting down all interested parties and having a frank, sometimes uncomfortable conversation about what people expect from each other. The next step is to put it all down in writing. Brian Hurd recently came up with an agreement which achieved a good outcome. An elderly mother needed care. A daughter was prepared to take on the responsibility, but she didn't have the room in her house. And suspicious siblings were alarmed at the prospect of their mother's assets going towards her home extensions when Mum could possibly die the following day. Brian Herd negotiated a written agreement whereby the elderly mother sold her house, gave the proceeds to her daughter, who used the money to build a granny flat. That transfer became a debt owed to the mother, but one which would, over time, be offset by the ongoing care she provided her mother. At the end of the day, everyone knew where they stood and what was expected of them. Sue Fields, the director of the Elder Law Centre at the University of Western Sydney. She says that even when thought is put into a family agreement, that doesn't necessarily mean they were arrived at properly.
In Urain and Whipper, that was a case of a 70-year-old man who, through discussions with his daughter, sold his property and paid a large sum of money, about 130,000 or so, towards the purchase of a new house for the daughter and her husband and family. And in exchange, he was to be able to live in, you know, the ubiquitous granny flat, and then he would be able to stay there as long as he was able. And I think the term was peaceably and without expense for as long as he may wish or his health permits.
And what happened? Did the relationship work out?
No, he didn't live happily ever after with the family, and he finished up shifting into an aged care facility and then sought to retrieve his money. And the matter did actually go to court, and it was held that there was no undue influence on the part of the daughter, but that there was what's called unconscionable conduct, and the court did find in his favour.
What's this notion of unconscionable conduct, and how was the daughter's conduct falling into that category?
Well, it's basically taking advantage of someone else's situation. In his case, he was 70-odd. I think he'd had a couple of strokes. He was mentally confused, and he required constant assistance, and it was held that that was sufficient to constitute a special disability. He also didn't have independent legal advice.
Was there anything in the behaviour of the daughter which might have led the court to find that she was putting pressure on her father?
I think in one instance, when she and the father were inspecting the proposed new property, she said something along the lines of, you know, if you don't do it this way, then I won't come and visit you again.
So effectively she emotionally blackmailed the man?
If you want to put it like that. When it comes to the issue of families, it's very difficult for someone perhaps in a more vulnerable position to stand up to a younger member of the family.
Now, Sue Fields, are all these types of cases decided in favour of the elderly person at the expense of the child?
No, not at all, because when the plaintiff is looking at recouping their money, as it were, they need to prove a number of factors. They need to prove that, you know, there was either undue influence or unconscionable conduct. And to do that, they must show that they were at a disadvantage. In a number of cases, it's held that the person knew what they were entering into, had the requisite mental capacity to enter into the arrangement, and perhaps because it just didn't work out, they then can't have the transaction overturned.
Sue Field from the University of Western Sydney. I'm Damien Carrick. You're listening to The Law Report on Radio National. Today, looking at money, the elderly and the law. It seems not much research has been done in this area. One person who has studied family agreements is Margaret Hall, Executive Director of the Centre for Elder Law at the Law Institute of British Columbia in Canada.
One of the big problems with care agreements is that they do tend to be very general and vague. It's usually nothing more than a promise either made orally or written down to take care of the other person or take care of them for the rest of their life. And now that is a very sort of vague and general phrase, and it can mean a lot of things. And one of the benefits of being explicit about what you're doing, instead of relying on a court eventually to read in reasonable limitations, is that between the two parties themselves, between the child who's doing the caregiving and the parent, writing things down makes it clear to both of them exactly what looking after mom is going to mean. So I'll give you an example. let's say that the property is transferred and the two parties start living together, well, mum might have expected that I promise to look after mum is going to mean, you know, I promise to take mum out to visit her friends on a regular basis when that's what mum wants to do, is going to mean I promise to keep the house tidy to the standards that mum has always kept, might mean I promise to keep the garden in the way that mum would like the garden to be kept. Whereas my apocryphal child that is receiving the property that's supposed to be doing the caregiving, he might have perceived that promise, I'm going to look after mum, to mean something really different. He might have thought it meant, well, I'll do mum's grocery shopping for her. He might not have understood it to mean, I'll cook all of mum's meals for her, which is something that mum might have understood. And so you have these kinds of misunderstandings that in turn can lead to real bitterness in the relationship.
Margaret Hall, I suppose there are also cases which revolve around questions of what actually constitutes looking after a parent.
Well, there was a very interesting case, Morgan and Morgan, and this again involved the older mother and the adult son, and the property was transferred to the son, and the mother and son agreed to live together on the property. And the mother is living in a mobile home while the son was building a new home on the property that they were going to live in together. And now she claimed, after the son had put a considerable degree of effort into building this new home for her, it was not yet completed, but he'd put a lot of work into it, that it wasn't the right kind of home. It wasn't the kind of home that she thought he was going to be building, and it wasn't the kind of home that she wanted him to be building. And there were other things that he was doing that, according to her, weren't being done the way that she wanted them to be done or the way that she expected them to be done. And so for this reason, his promise to look after her, which she said is why she transferred the property to him, had been broken. Now, subsequently, the court, sort of looking into the personal relationships that were involved, and this is one of the special features of these cases where they are reported by the courts, is there's a much greater inclination of the courts here to really delve into the interpersonal relationships, much more than you usually see in reported court cases. Found that the real root of the mother's problems was a new relationship that her son had developed while he was living with his mom, and she didn't like the relationship. I don't know if it's because she didn't like this woman or just because she didn't want her son to be in a relationship. And you got this kind of picture of maybe the mother had thought, well, it's just going to be me and my son now, you know, living on this property, and he's going to be looking after me for the rest of my life. And then unexpected things happen. We'd always expect to meet somebody and fall in love or form new relationships that changed her expectations in a very radical way. Now, maybe they could have written something down in a written agreement about the kind of home that he was going to build, and that might have resolved that problem, but they never could have expected or made written provision for it, the son meeting somebody and falling in love. I mean, there are some things that you just can't provide for in a written contract.
You don't normally contract away your love life.
No. No. One would hope not anyway. Mm. Not even in return for the family farm.
Margaret Hall from the Law Institute of British Columbia. And of course, romance causing friction can cut both ways. All too often, children have their own concerns about dad's new wife. Just think Anna Nicole Smith. Of course, elderly parents often give control of their assets to the kids, but not outright ownership, by giving their child an enduring power of attorney. That device effectively assigns control of financial affairs. To make such an assignment, you do, of course, have to be of sound mind. In legal speak, have capacity. But lawyer Brian Hurd says, all too often, children will cut dangerous corners if they think their parents are beginning to fail.
I have many, many cases and examples of that very sort of scenario, where families reach a crisis point where, for example, mum or dad is starting to show signs of incapacity, and the children start to panic when they realise that, in fact, mum or dad hasn't made an enduring power of attorney, and they can see the control of their mother's affairs being, in fact, taken over by some statutory protector, such as a public trustee. Now, when you get to that sort of crisis management situation, what can often happen is that sons or daughters can be desperate for mum or dad to sign an enduring power of attorney. And in many cases, what that means is they will try and prevail upon appropriate professionals who have to be satisfied about the capacity of someone to make an enduring power of attorney to overlook any concern about the person's capacity in order to get that document in place. I have a case at the moment, for example, where a particular woman was asked by her daughter to make an enduring power of attorney, and she took her mother to 7 separate solicitors in order to get those solicitors to verify and attest to the capacity of the mother to make that enduring power of attorney. She couldn't get any of them to do so, and then finally had to take her mother to a solicitor in another town who promptly agreed to attest to the mother's capacity to make that document. He was the 8th solicitor that she had taken her mother to. Now, the reality was in that case that the woman did not have the necessary capacity to make that enduring power of attorney, but the daughter's drive to make sure that it was done resulted in effectively a professional performing a role negligently.
Has that enduring power of attorney been contested?
It has. An application's been made by another person to be appointed the guardian and administrator of that person in substitution for what we now say is an invalid enduring power of attorney.
It's complicated though, isn't it? Because I don't know about this case, but the motivations of family members may well be coming from a good place or maybe even a mixed place, but not necessarily a bad one.
That's true. The children will be well-intentioned because they don't want, nor probably does mum or dad want, the affairs of mum and dad controlled by a faceless bureaucrat, such as someone from the public trustee's office. They would much rather, all of them, have the affairs of mum and dad dealt with within the family. That's all very understandable. But the reality is, the law of capacity must be complied with. A document made by someone who has lost capacity is invalid and cannot be acted upon. And the result of many of these marginal cases of capacity where older people are on the cusp of capacity is that many times members of the family will prevail upon professionals such as justices of the peace and lawyers to attest to these documents when in fact they shouldn't. And I'm very concerned about that.
Do you ever see misuse or abuse of a power of attorney?
All the time, Damien. I've got a case at the moment where there is a lady in a nursing home. There is some argument or issue about whether she has indeed lost the necessary capacity to give instructions, but she has one son, and that son has her enduring power of attorney. I had an anonymous phone call from someone asking me to go and see this woman in the nursing home, and I went to see her and got some information about her financial affairs, and also she expressed some concern about what the son was doing in relation to her financial affairs. Namely, he wasn't telling her anything about what her financial affairs were because he had total control over the bank accounts. I then spoke to the son and asked him to produce all the necessary financial records. He produced some of them, and some of them indicated that there were significant withdrawals of money from her various bank accounts. She was a woman of some substance. Various withdrawals that he could not account for at all, because they were large withdrawals in cash for round figures, which suggested they were simply withdrawn for all sorts of nefarious purposes. Now, at the moment, we've got a situation where he has now spoken to his mother in my absence and convinced her that she shouldn't pursue the matter anymore. I call that a case of perhaps undue influence, where effectively he said to her, "Mum, this is not in your interests or mine to have a lawyer involved investigating these affairs. It's really a matter between you and me. I'm your son. You're my mother. Why should we have any outside people involved?" But the reality is, this particular son doesn't understand the first thing about his duties as an attorney, doesn't understand the first thing about his mother's obligations in relation to such things as Social Security, the taxation department. He simply thinks he can arrange his mother's affairs to suit himself because his mother is simply unaware and doesn't need to know, because ultimately he will be the only beneficiary of her estate. So why should anyone intervene?
What's the solution? A criminal prosecution for, effectively embezzlement?
Well, that's one option, and indeed that is an option, because people who take money as we think he has are stealing money. There's no doubt about that. And they can argue until they're blue in the face that they're really stealing their own money, because ultimately it will be theirs when mum or dad dies, but the reality is they are stealing the money. And the consequence of stealing it can in fact be that the quality of life of mum or dad suffers substantially. And this case is a classic example of that, because he will not spend money for her, even though she has significant assets, and even though she hates living in this facility, which she's told me, she has the financial capacity to live in her own home and be provided with community care, where she'd rather be. That, however, is a much more expensive option for the son than living in a nursing home, even though that would be, for her, a much happier environment. But he will not do it, because to do so would deplete his mum's estate.
Does she have capacity? Is she in a position to undo the enduring power of attorney?
That's a difficult question in this particular case, because, as you may know, capacity fluctuates. You can be capable sometimes one day and not the next. In fact, my practice generally is what I call a morning practice, because I prefer to see many of my older clients in the morning, when they are more likely to be capable, than in the afternoon, because they suffer from what's called the sundown syndrome, when they start to get very difficult to understand, for example, or to get instructions from when the sun goes down. So generally speaking, this particular woman I found to be capable on the day I first saw her. I then saw her the next day, and I found her to be incapable of giving me instructions. Now, there could be other external reasons for that in terms of the conduct of her son, but within the space of 2 days, she went, in my assessment, from being capable to the next day when she was incapable of giving me instructions. But be that as it may, if you can get instructions from someone when they are capable, that's sufficient, irrespective of whether the next day they become incapable.
Are there ever cases of criminal charges being laid?
There's only one case I'm aware of where a prosecution was made against an attorney in the last 2 years for effectively stealing money. And I think that was in relation to a son who effectively stole money as an enduring attorney for his mother to support a significant drug habit. But that's the only prosecution I'm aware of. But I suspect, Damien, there is a significant undercurrent of this sort of thing going on.
Brian Hurd, partner with Cain & Hurd Solicitors in Brisbane. I'm Damien Carrick. You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Louise Gilmore is the president of Carers Australia. She says it's not just the elderly who are vulnerable. Australia's 500,000 home carers can also get the short end of the stick.
The pressures on carers are often 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week demands on their availability and their time, and very little in the way of income support that enables them to keep going at any sort of reasonable level. They often have to give up work. Their lives shrink. They become much more limited in what they can do. They're often unable to maintain friendships, other relationships, leisure activities. So often we find that carers are extremely isolated no matter where they live in the country.
Do you ever find that people do, as they become older and frailer and sometimes paranoid, that they do lash out and wrongly accuse their carers?
Yes, and we have certainly have heard of cases where carers are actually abused by people that they are looking after, perhaps, as you say, people who maybe have dementia or whose personalities change in some way.
And, of course, many carers make extensive changes to their life and to their finances. Can they be left in a difficult situation if those people turn around and wrongly accuse them?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And if carers have given up their own incomes to care for someone, the spiral is down into poverty unless there's some money in the family. I mean, we know through research we've done at the Carers Association that carers are likely to be both poorer and sicker than the rest of the population. So, yes, they could be really left high and dry.
Do you think, on the flip side, that there are issues around, I guess, carers, some carers very, very occasionally, say, abusing or misusing powers of attorney?
Yes, I guess that would be true. Carers are human beings and I guess they cover the whole range. I mean, the carers that we come in contact with are mostly really honest people who are doing the best that they can in a difficult situation, but I've no doubt that there are occasions when various powers are abused.
Louise Gilmore, President of Carers Australia. Paula Scully's the adult guardian in Queensland. It's her job to protect the interests of adults who lack capacity, including many elderly people who may be suffering from dementia or the effects of a stroke. She confirms that sometimes those who are granted an enduring power of attorney abuse and misuse the trust placed in them.
Well, one common example is where we get a referral from a nursing home saying that over a period of months, even up to $7,000 to $15,000 has been unpaid in nursing home fees. And then when we investigated, we discovered that the son or daughter, who is the financial attorney, has spent this money on buying a new car or an expensive holiday or renovations to their own home. We also have situations where banks will refer, where they're suspecting that a relative, and maybe that person isn't under an enduring power of attorney, is actually wanting to have a joint account and withdraw a considerable sum, which is different to the normal pattern of withdrawals that the senior had.
So rather than $100 every week, they start withdrawing $1,000
yes,
at a time.
Or they do a lump sum. It's often more common to have a lump sum rather than a kind of gradual increase in a daily or weekly or monthly withdrawal. And it's quite surprising when you look at accounts to discover that such a large sum could be withdrawn and that a bank didn't actually notice that or challenge the attorney to say, well, why are you withdrawing such a large sum? Because after all, banks do owe a duty of care to the principal. The account is still in the principal's name. And yet this kind of abuse is happening. And unfortunately, by the time the referral is made to us sometimes, then the money has gone, it's spent, and it cannot be recovered.
What sorts of obligations are placed on banks to monitor and report suspect transactions of this kind?
There are no mandatory reporting requirements. Banks do owe a duty of care, of course, under the common law, to their account holders. Confidentiality and privacy sometimes gets in the way, where perhaps in other jurisdictions they have concerns that they're breaching those requirements and therefore they don't feel they can report.
And realistically, are authorities able to step in and do something to stop the rot or even claw back assets?
Yes, I mean, in some cases the public trustees actually take proceedings in the civil courts against attorneys and manage to recover the money. But sadly, in some cases that is not possible because the money has been spent and the attorney himself or herself doesn't have very much money.
I believe in the USA there's a phenomenon known as granny dumping. Can you tell me about that?
I am aware of situations where an elder is admitted to a hospital or a nursing home and false phone numbers and false addresses are given by family, and then when the social workers or the nurses ring up, they discover that those relatives have moved on and there are no relatives around. And, you know, granny has been dumped and no fees are being paid and the relatives have disappeared perhaps into another state. I think that this is a great tragedy. At the same time, I do appreciate the stress on carers, but there are many organisations there to support carers. They may not be adequately funded, but, you know, this is not an excuse. Stress or carer stress is not an excuse for abuse.
Paula Scully, the adult guardian in Queensland. That's the program for this week. Thanks as usual to Law Report producer, the wonderful Maria Tickle, and also to technical producer this week, Brendan O'Neill. Don't forget, the Law Report's now repeated each Tuesday evening after the 8pm news here on Radio National. And of course, a transcript and audio will be available from the ABC website at abc.net.au/rn from a little bit later on today.